Hello everyone and welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave, a community-hosted podcast originating in our love for George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire. My name is Bina 007 and I'll be hosting the 43rd instalment of our linear reread. We will have full spoilers for all of George R. R. Martin's written works, but not the TV show Game of Thrones. Before we get started, this is a bit unusual, as we're nearing our 400th episode of VOC, we really want to celebrate in style with a podcast awards nomination, which is something you may or may not know exists. But if you are so minded, you can help us out. If you visit podcastawards.com, you can nominate podcasts in a range of categories, including many that are not us. If you feel like it, we would really appreciate it if you could nominate VOC in film and TV and People's Choice. Okay, so that little plea for votes behind me, let's get on with the show. So, today I'm joined by my fellow VOK curator, Adam.
Hey, it's me, Adam.
Do you want to give your forum name?
Oh, I suppose. Drown Snow on the forums.
And in case you're wondering, those are the forums of A Podcast of Ice and Fire, which is where you can find us and get involved in VOC if you'd like to. We've got also the lovely Mary.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Bina. And it's Nymeria on the forums. Same forums.
And today we're also joined by Matt, who I recently met in Washington with Casey, aka Blue Eyed Queen, a little mini moot we had. So it's great to have you on, Matt.
Yeah, thanks. I guess I'm Blue Armor on the forums.
Great. So as it's your first time on, we have to ask you all the standard questions. So how did you get into the books?
It was around the time Feast for Crows came out, end of 2005, early 2006. I don't remember much from that read. I was only, I would have just turned 17. It was like maybe my third fantasy series I'd ever read. I found it by randomly walking through a Borders and looking for, you know, long series that had multiple books.
Oh, in those days of physical bookstores, those days of yore.
And a cover that wasn't like the traditional, you know, stereotypical fantasy cover, like the ones you would see on like Wheel of Time or something like that. So I picked it up. I was intrigued by the POV chapter style. And so I just grabbed the first one. I remember being annoyed at Bran getting pushed out a window. I actually like flipped forward to make sure he was still alive before I kept reading the book. And then I got to the end and Ned's death convinced me to immediately buy the rest of the books.
So you have done a wait before. You've done the Dance with Dragons wait.
Yeah, that was a long time. I managed to find other things to occupy it in the meantime. I mean, that was my kind of my start into reading the fantasy genre. That's pretty much all I read now.
Wise man.
And then for the podcast, so I eventually reread the books in 2008, a couple years later. And that's where I really like started to learn like how to properly read fantasy and like pick up on the nuances. And then I, you know, would Google things online. And so, you know, it's all melded together of what I figured out on my own and what I read online. Conveniently, around the time that was the same year the podcast started. I have no idea what episode I came on. I always assumed it was around like 15 or so. I could maybe make a guess if I knew, you know, the exact release date. but I looked up the titles and the first Guys and Girls Nights Out, which I do remember was what convinced me to keep listening to the podcast, were like episodes 7 and 8. So I might have come in even earlier than that.
How come it took you so long to like, I mean, I kind of a little bit harassed you at Washington. I was like, you have to be on a podcast, Matt. But
I knew that question was coming. It was first just because I'd never had any interest in participating in online forums. I always thought it was too much work and people essentially are, I mean, with the exception of like this forum, people are usually just assholes on the internet.
'Tis true.
So I eventually like gave it and joined a year after they were created just to talk about the show a bit, but then, you know, left off. And then you guys started the VOK thing around the time Dance came out, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I think it was a little after, right?
There is no offense meant by this, but I did listen to those first few episodes. You guys just weren't as polished as you are now. So I kind of just left off it, and I didn't have a lot of time to listen to podcasts in the first place.
I mean, not even that polished like, now.
Yeah, I was about to say thank you.
But you have like you at least have like the humor down now and the back and forth, and there's a lot less, you know, breaks in between people speaking and whatnot. And also
that's the
now
miracle of editing, sir.
Right, yeah, that too. And now I work at jobs that allow me to listen to podcasts while I'm at work. So I listen to a lot more nowadays. So yeah, I started listening to you guys in full about, I don't know, probably around a year ago. I enjoyed the rereads. Like, they're my favorite part. So
cool. And so are you still watching the show, or have you given up?
Yeah, I am, actually. I was always really lenient on the show. I never really understood the anger behind it. I was always able to keep the two entities separate pretty well. However, I still haven't
except
watched
for season five.
Right, season five is the exception. They did the
no
one
spoilers,
thing.
No spoilers, because yeah, Mary yeah, and I aren't watching. Generic concern can be expressed.
yeah. So it was the change in Sansa's storyline. Like, I never thought I would get like angry enough at the show to make me watch it or to make me stop watching it. And then the thing happened with Sansa, and I legitimately just clicked off the episode that night and said I wasn't going back. But my mom still watches the show, and so she would always call and ask me questions. So I kept up with it and eventually came back for when they did the first part of the Tower of Joy scene in season six. And so I started watching again, and it was enjoyable enough. I actually really liked it. And it's separate enough now from the books that, you know, it's just kind of fun to watch. Also, in general, like, season six, like, even though it surpasses the books, there was only really one event that I felt spoiled for. Everything else was fairly predictable given what we know so far. So it doesn't bother me that much.
Okay, that's cool. So are you going to potentially take part in Dragoncast this year? If I add a
bit, yeah,
and once you've answered that, maybe Drown Snow, Adam, you want to tell the listeners a bit about how we're going to be covering the show this year?
Well, Bina, just so you know, Game of Thrones is back tomorrow. I don't know if you knew that, but we're going to be having kind of our standard coverage. A few of us will be getting together tomorrow night for the premiere, and that'll be pretty raw, but it should be going up not too long after the premiere. And then we'll probably be releasing on Mondays or Tuesdays after that, I would think. It's going to be a little different than in past years. And there's only 7 episodes this year. So, yeah, we might try some new things. I don't know. Maybe a little less rigid format, maybe. I don't know.
There you go, Matt.
We'll see.
You have something to join if you like tonight.
Right, yeah, and Adam just sent me, like, a super long thread that I now have to catch up on and read.
Oh, God, don't try to read that whole thing. We have, like, there's a show thread on Skype for people that are watching the show, and I think that's, like, a couple months old, so it goes back quite a ways.
Oh, God. All right, well, I'll see.
Cool. Yeah, but that's like basically mostly for scheduling it, people who want to be on, and then they can go to the individual episode records from there.
And finally, Matt, sort of any particular characters or storylines or things that are your favorite in this world?
If I have to like narrow it down to one, it's Arya is my favorite POV to read. Davos and Jaime are pretty close behind that. Those are the three chapters I look forward to the most.
And where would Dany rank in that list?
I mean, it's really just like there are two types of chapters for me. They're the ones where I'm both interested in the character and their storyline, and then there's ones that I'm more interested in the story that's going on around them than their individual thoughts. And so I don't know. I mean, Dany's the same as all the others to me. Like, it's not really that.
Dany has always kind of felt a little bit like it's a different story. It's like there's all the other chapters and then there's Dany chapters, right?
For sure.
So, yeah.
I was just really shocked when I was, and you can all see this on the show notes, when I was making notes as I was reading today's chapters, I had so much on the first two, and then I got to Dany, and it's by far the longest chapter. And a lot of stuff happens, but I just didn't have notes because none of it felt provocative to me or raised questions. So I'm really curious to see how that discussion goes. Cool. Anyway, Matt, it's great to have you on. Welcome.
Could we take a second, maybe after or before now, whatever, and maybe discuss recent events, maybe?
Recent events being what? Like George's blog post?
Yes. What the hell?
What the hell is that?
Okay. Mary, do you want to maybe give your reaction first?
I think I already did.
Adam, you raised it. You obviously have feelings.
I just, it's too confusing to me. You know, no one seems to want to, you know, it seems like everyone either wants to believe like, oh man, he's about to announce wins, or like, nope, he's just gone over the deep end and he's just screwing with everyone. I don't know what makes sense anymore. It doesn't make sense to me that he's just screwing with everyone. That seems weird, but you know, whatever, he can do whatever he wants. I don't know. It doesn't make sense that it's about, like, the Game of Thrones premiere or about the Valerian being available to learn on the Duolingo app. Because, like, why wouldn't he just say that? It's just weird. It's just very weird. Like, I don't know. I don't want to be like, we're getting the book soon because, you know, I've been hurt before, Bina. But,
baby. I mean, I think I expressed how I felt on Twitter pretty, which is basically, and I'll just read it. I'm rapidly losing respect for George R. R. Martin. No, he doesn't owe us anything, but he knows we're on tenterhooks, so this sort of post is just cruel. If he's lost heart in A Song of Ice and Fire and isn't going to finish, why not commission someone else to do it and give them his plot points? It would be more honest. I'm sick of this wanton flirting. So that was obviously a very bitter set of tweets, and obviously in reading these three chapters for today, I realized how much I love his writing, and so that's kind of very ungrateful. But he knows we're on tenterhooks. Don't give us a dick pic. Give us something real.
What he usually doesn't, though, so that's why it's weird. Yeah.
Well, then that speaks to an amazing lack of awareness. I mean,
he had several posts where he was very close. Well, he's not unaware because the comments were disabled, and like he posted like, you know, mood, you know, enigmatic. Like you're like, you know, he knew that people were going to lose their minds over this. Like right now, I'm sort of where you are, but I'm waiting for Monday because it could be something where he's like, well, he's sort of wanting to tease something and get people excited. And then like maybe he's going to announce something. Maybe it's not wins, but maybe it's something significant. Hopefully it would be wins, like to go with the premiere. That's what I would think. But if he doesn't, if like Monday rolls around and we have nothing, then I'm ready to go like, what the hell?
How about you, Max? What's your reaction? Are you calm? Are you zen? Are you pissed off?
Yeah, I'm used to this. so it doesn't bother me. Like he's not the greatest with marketing and whatnot. And I mean, he doesn't make as many hopeful posts as he did in the past because he learned somewhat, but he's still I feel like doesn't get it fully. But no, like I'm with Adam where wait till Monday. Like it would make it was dumb of him to put an hour reference like in the post itself.
Everyone took that to be a literal hour, which I don't think that's what he meant. But
right. But and that's just something that was like, I feel like a younger person would see that as obvious, like, oh, I should take that out if I'm not going to announce it right away. But yeah, it makes sense to wait till Monday, till after the premiere, just because it would make sense to announce something with that. However, the post itself doesn't make sense for wins just because it was based on Valyria. Like, it makes more sense that he would, you know, drop another, like, short story.
Like a spoiler chapter, maybe, or something.
Well, I feel like something like some of, like, the extra material he wrote for, like, A World of Ice and Fire, just more specifics about, like, the history of Valyria. And so you would just drop it in another anthology. Like, that's the thing that makes most sense to me.
Okay, so with that little bit of wins angst, let's get on with the chapters that we do actually have. So in the last episode of the linear reread, we left John at the Fist of First Men and Arya watching the Karstark men trash the countryside. And that was all on 12th of November 299. So in today's episode, we're covering the events of the next 2 days, the 13th and 14th of November. And that's three chapters, Jaime 4, Cat 4, and Dany 5 from A Storm of Swords. So, interestingly, Arya 4, which is where we left off last time, was the 23rd chapter of Storm, and we jump forward a massive 14 chapters, which is about 100 pages in my edition, to Jaime 4. So we're going to have some quite big sort of time jumps or narrative jumps this episode. And I believe it's Adam who's going to do the chapter summary.
Yeah, so we've got Jaime, who has just recently lost his hand, and it's hanging around his neck, and he's just a big old sad sack.
I mean, in fairness, he didn't lose it. He didn't mislay it. I mean, it was brutally cut from his arm.
It was taken from him, and I suppose, yes, he knows exactly where it is, and it's just no longer attached.
Yeah, it's hanging around his neck, and in a very meaningful way, he hasn't actually lost it.
Yeah, it's pretty brutal. They had a really good Jaime cosplay at the Con of Thrones with a hand around the neck. Anyway, so yeah, that's pretty brutal, and he kind of just wants to die. At one point, he tries to escape, but quickly realizes he's no good with his left hand with the sword, and they really totally humiliate him, which for someone who's such a great swordsman, I'm sure is pretty rough. Then he learns that they're going to Harrenhal, which he finds kind of ironic because that's where he earned his white cloak and everything. And then, they try to rape Brienne, which is not cool. And Jaime kind of steps in on that a little bit as best as he can. And then by the time they get to Harrenhal and That's reported to Roose. He's not too happy. He's also not too happy with the way they've treated him. But at this point, it kind of doesn't matter. And Brienne does... This is like kind of the beginning of the Brienne and Jaime ship, I guess, where she kind of helps to convince him to go on. And then he gets treatment from Qyburn, who just wants to cut his arm off. But Jaime's not pretty happy with that. I think he threatens to kill Qyburn at one point. And yeah, he's basically ends the chapter as just kind of a sad shell of a man.
So Adam, thank you very much for that chapter summary. And it's just time to say hello to Nadia before we get into the discussion. Hey, Nadia.
Hi, everyone.
Great to have you on. Okay, so I'm not sure how much...
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just, with that discussion on George's post, it was 5:30 a.m., I think, when Adam sent that message to the Skype thread. And I don't know, it woke me up, and then I was like awake for the next couple of hours, just waiting for something to happen.
Oh, no!
Thanks a lot, Adam.
Yeah, everyone like, set their kitchen timers and were like, okay, it's been an hour, nothing's happening. I was like, oh, no, I didn't think it would literally be an hour, but yeah.
And apparently neither did George. So we all feel each other's pain. So thoughts on this chapter? I mean, I've got questions, but does anyone else want to dive in? I have a practical one. Why do they keep searing his stump again and again? Is that for torture or for medical reasons? Like, do you do it to seal the wound?
It shouldn't be for medical reasons. They wouldn't really probably have a lot of knowledge of that. But, I mean, maybe they did it poorly and they've got him in bad conditions and it's kind of getting gross. And so they're just like, well, let's burn it off and, you know, to try to clean it up a little maybe. I feel like it's mostly just because they want to torture him.
Okay.
Actually, like a decent amount of foreshadowing, I feel, in this chapter. There's a couple things. This is like the first mention where Jaime talks about getting like a new golden hand, and he dreams of ripping out Varga Hoth's throat.
I know.
This is where I always got the image of him using his golden hand to choke Cersei to death. That's always been like my hope for like the future of that particular storyline, just because I thought it'd be a cool image. And we also get that, you know, we will die together as we were born together line. This chapter is referenced to Cersei.
Do you think that's prophetic? Do you think that's going to actually happen?
So it's interesting where it's entirely possible, especially if they run a parallel with Cersei to Aerys, in that Jaime like ends up killing her in order to stop her from setting off wildfire like in King's Landing.
That'd be so cool.
But in a few chapters or a couple chapters, we get that dream sequence with him and Brienne. Kind of, it does reference like their fight against the bear later in the chapter, but it also like provides images that are similar to Jon, you know, like fighting in the snow or darkness with flaming swords. So it's possible that him and Brienne have more of a future storyline fighting the others together.
Nice.
Kind of just up in the air where it could go either way, I feel.
I think the way Jaime and Cersei's storylines are going, they're rather being separated more and more. And so if indeed they die together, it won't be as Jaime imagines it in a romantic way. Because that's not, at least at the moment, that's not where they're going. You know, Jaime is slowly getting sober, if I may say so. Like he's not as intoxicated with her as he is right now.
I completely agree. I think it's more what Matt said, that whether or not he specifically kills her, he'll choose to go down with her at the sinking of a Lannister ship. And that will be quite poetic in itself, but not romantic. I actually think there's a lot of really lovely, deep character stuff for Jaime in this chapter. When he's like talking about the pain, he says, "Then he made his eyes go dry and his heart go dead." It's what he did when he basically saw the Stark, Papa Stark, get killed in King's Landing. And I find that, you know, this retreating to avoid pain is a way in which he thinks he has something in common with Brienne, that if they rape her, that she'll just go behind her walls and she'll go behind her walls. And I think it's kind of, it's nice that Jaime is that observant. He's actually much more observant and sensitive than you would have ever thought when you first meet him in Game of Thrones. So...
Definitely.
I like that about him.
It's also the same advice he gives Dormund after Tywin dies. And that was kind of a really sweet moment between Dormund and Jaime.
And it's just so sad. And I think maybe I'm really looking forward to seeing Jaime in the future books, because I'm wondering if he'll manage to go beyond this sort of repressing everything, not talking about it, to being someone who can actually confront what his relationship with Cersei has been. He's starting to do that mentally, but to really kind of articulate that openly with her and physically and actually just move beyond it. I think he's at a really interesting point. And there's also something he says about Tyrion when, now as a cripple, he says he can sympathise for Tyrion and quote, "Now I know how Tyrion felt all those times that they laughed at him." He doesn't say we laughed at him, which again shows that he was always the guy who had a soft spot for Tyrion. And I just think this empathy, it's lovely, and it's a marker on his journey to being less of an absolute sort of selfish, almost nihilistic lover of Cersei to something much more whole and interesting.
Well, I mean, don't you think at his core he's actually a pretty great guy? Like, growing up in a different environment, having different parts of him nurtured, not having to deal with Tywin or not having that relationship with his sister, he probably would have been like more of a true knight.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I really love Jaime as he currently stands, and I think if he'd have been raised by Brandon Stark rather than by Tywin Lannister, he would have been a really great guy. And maybe not even being raised by a different father, but just not having this incestuous, bizarrely sort of coercive relationship with his sister. I mean, that really is like this cancer that takes over his personality.
I think that's not the only thing. That's part of it, but everything that happened with Aerys is another big part of it. He's really...
Oh, for sure.
It's why he is always protecting himself from anything that anyone else thinks, because everything with Aerys has a lot to do with the way he is, I think. But I think I agree. He's a really he's a sensitive person, and I feel like it's we feel that in the writing. Like, it struck me today that the writing, George's writing for Jaime's chapters, it's really poetic. Like, it was already the case in the previous ones, and here it's gruesome and violent and a lot of pain, but he has this paragraph where he's like, the night was strangely beautiful, and he watches the stars and everything. And I think, he has this sensitive strand to him.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that the writing matches it, or the style of writing matches it. And I always feel when I'm reading Jaime chapters that George also kind of loves this character and then has a lot of sympathy for him.
Yeah, and I think he intended this, from the start, and that's why we didn't get Jaime chapters earlier, because he didn't want us to know, what was going on with him.
Absolutely.
Well, they would have been pretty one-sided. It's not until he loses his hand that he's forced to adapt to his situation, and that there would have been no character development if we just saw his chapters early on.
It's only at this point where... Jaime in Game of Thrones, I want to fuck Cersei, shit happens, I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
I hope Robert doesn't find out.
I don't think he even cared. I think he was just reckless.
I think you think he would have killed him if he walked in on him, he just would have killed Robert right there.
Yeah, probably. He was just recklessly in love. He pushed Bran out the window. I mean, that's just, so long as he could keep that love, that incest going.
He pushed Bran out of the window like he was just moving some furniture, kind of like, oh, well, it's, you got to make give us some privacy, throw this kid out the window.
Yeah, and a bit of caustic wit at the end. Oh, the things I do for love. I mean, it's bizarre.
It was all he had.
with his whole changing and becoming a better man, does he ever reminisce on Bran and regret it? Or, I mean, is it something that haunts him or not? Because I feel it doesn't come up in his mind often.
Yeah, I think the only time he thinks about Bran is when he's threatening Edmure that he'll throw his baby over the walls of Riverrun if he doesn't give up, Riverrun.
Yeah.
I don't think he thinks of it at any other point. You know, when Edmure is telling him, it's just a pet, you'd never do that. And then Jaime thinks, I've already done it.
It comes up with Cersei, where she's like, you shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. My feeling is that he just compartmentalizes, and an aspect of going away inside is just knowing what to lock away. So he pushed Brad out the window, he just locks that away. And I think that, up until really quite late in the books, you never see him really thinking about Tommen and Marcella as his children and thinking, what a shame I didn't get to raise them, it's awful that they grew up in a lie. There are just certain things he just doesn't think about, even in POV chapters. And I think that's just part of this whole don't think about it, repress it, move forward.
Because if he thinks too much about the children, like, you know, maybe it's hard for him, you'd think.
Of course, yeah. I think it's just part of his coping mechanism. I mean, I'm willing to admit that I am genuinely in love with Jamie, so I'm probably, like, throwing him a free pass on a lot of these things. But it's the way that I rationalize
it. I think with Tommen and Myrcella, Jamie thinks, you know, he does think they were never my children because Cersei didn't let them be my children. Like, she didn't ever let Jamie interact with them beyond, you know, a very superficial way.
But do we know that she specifically didn't let him interact, or is it just that he didn't bother trying?
I think there was a mention in one of Jamie's chapters where he thinks, you know, the children were all Cersei's. Like, she was so possessive about them that she couldn't share them, not even the Jamie.
Gosh.
But he's the uncle at the very least. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, because Tyrion has a nice relationship, doesn't he, with Myrcella? And he's exactly, like the goofy uncle that they love, and he joshes around with them. So Jamie could at least have tried for that. Mary?
I just think that he didn't try, not really. Like you're saying, Tyrion does have some kind of a relationship, and Jaime really doesn't. At least it appears that he doesn't, and he could probably have.
Yeah, there's never mention of him, like, teaching Joffrey any sort of, like, sword skills or any, like, even basic stuff that, as the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard and his uncle, you think would be, like, automatic. It doesn't seem like he does.
Yeah. So the whole thing is incredibly sad. I mean, I think both he and Brienne are quite clever in this chapter. So she's quite clever in knowing how to reverse psychology him into, not reverse psychology, but when she sees he's just giving up and despondent, she kind of tells him not to be a coward, and that sort of shocks him into living. But when she shocks him into living, which is really clever, he says, "I want to live for Cersei. And then I want to live for revenge." And I thought, oh God, that's so sad. Like, he's still, as much as he's on that road to being different, he's still so in love with her. And then I was thinking, what is the timeline? Is she already cheating on him with the kettle blacks at this point? Or does that come later?
Well, Lancel was already going on, for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
This
probably.
Poor delusional schmuck. Really is.
I mean, so, like, because for Cersei, Jaime is all hers, right? But for Jaime, like, he's always had to share her with Robert. And, I mean, who knows what else, you know, Cersei's been up to. She seems to play that card pretty liberally, so.
Do you think that Jaime knows that she cheats on him or sleeps with people other than her husband and him?
I don't think so. I don't really think so, because, like, that's the dig that Tyrion gets on him all the time, you know, before the trial and stuff. It's like, you know, she's sleeping with Osmond Kettleblack and Moonboy, for all I know. And it like, rings in his head over and over again, right?
Yeah.
As sort of something that it's not a concept that he's used to.
Yeah, you're probably right. I also found it kind of, like, really sad that when he shouts out Sapphires and sort of basically saves Brienne from getting raped, he has to kind of explain it to her as well. You know, you saved me before, so now, and a Lannister always pays his debts. He can't just admit that he likes her and he's being a good friend and just trying to help her out.
And he's trying to help, yeah.
Yeah, he still has to put up a little bit of a front with her and, like, well, you know, this is just
what... Sapphires.
Yeah, exactly. Sapphires.
Yeah, he's lying to himself even before he's lying to her. I mean, he cannot accept it that he would actually be nice and try to save her from something truly awful.
I think in spite of himself, he has respect for her kind of right away. You know what I mean? Like, deep inside. And he just, it's hard for him to come to grips with that.
Yeah, he still has a sense of honor. It's just the fact that he just decided to dive into the Kingslayer persona just because everyone, like, forced it upon him. So his choice was just to dive right into that instead of trying to counter them, because he knew no one would believe him and listen to his side of the story. And so at this point, he's still kind of maintaining that false persona of his.
Yeah, I think that's really spot on. And then I guess the other thing that kind of happens in this chapter is that Jaime learns that the Freys are really pissed off with the Starks and sort of pricks up his ears. You get, like, a massive info dump, don't you, at the end of this chapter, or effectively you get Bolton sort of bringing him up to speed.
Yeah.
So I guess we've probably covered this in other chapters. The Red Wedding plot is already happening, right? Precisely when in this timeline do Walder, Rhys and Tywin start writing to each other and planning this? So it's obviously before this, because in the next day we're going to get the catch up to where the wedding invitation goes out. But Jamie's not in on it, or is, like, at what point is he in on it?
I don't think he's ever in on it.
But then he says he
might suspect, but...
Like, I think in this chapter and in this chapter and probably the next one, he feels that something is not right. Like, he's not in... I mean, Bolton is still openly loyal to Rob. Yeah, but he's like he knows something is up, but he's never really in on it. I think the whole alliance between Frey, Bolton, and Lannister is, I mean, it starts when, like, after the Battle of the Blackwater, when Tyrion meets with Tywin, so it's probably a couple of weeks after the battle, and it's when Tywin says that some battles are won with sword and others with ink and paper or with letters. I don't remember what he says exactly, but I feel
quills
like...
Quills or something.
Yeah, that's the point where... We learn that he's writing to people, and I think that's probably writing to the Westerlings, if that happened already, I'm not sure, and to Bolton.
Yeah, the whole Jaime thing would be what decided Bolton. Like, that would have been the moment that Bolton decided to change.
Yeah.
He would have been on the fence before, but that would have solidified it.
Yeah.
I think Tywin, he puts out feelers, right? But I think it all comes together very quickly once Rob breaks his oath.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right.
And yeah, Jaime makes that comment, like, that Rob lost the war when he hears, like, that statement. But, like, over the whole tactics of the war just aren't his concern at the moment. He's just trying to make it home to King's Landing alive.
Indeed. And then the final point I just wanted to make in this chapter is it really reminded me of not just how much sympathy Jaime has for Tyrion, but that they're actually really similar. The bit where Qyburn's cutting off his arm and he's refusing pain meds because he doesn't want to wake up and be amputated. And Qyburn's like, there will be pain. I'll scream. There will be a lot of pain. I'll scream very loudly. I mean, that's very Tyrion.
And he does.
And he does, and he passes out. But yeah, that just really reminded me of the similarity of the two brothers. I kind of like that.
It's like, yeah, I don't trust you, so I'll deal with it.
Yeah, you've got to admire that balls. Any other comments, observation from people on this chapter?
There's a line that I hadn't, like, noticed before on previous rereads, and it's about Tyrion. So it says Tyrion is a little brother who loved him for a lie. And there's another line when he's talking to Catelyn all the way back in Clash of Kings, where, you know, I find it passing odd that I'm loved by one for a kindness I never did, and relieved and reviled by so many for my finest act. It's the first time I really noticed that there was actually foreshadowing to the Tysha reveal at the end of Storm. Where I just assume that those two lines kind of reference that particular moment. And so I thought that was interesting that George, like, set that up.
Yeah, brilliant. And it just shows what a master craftsman he is to weave that in so early as well. It's really fantastic.
Yeah.
Mary?
Yeah, just about what we were saying right before. In the timeline, it says that Rob takes the crag, at least they get the news that he takes the crag, like mid-August. And in one Arya chapter in Harrenhal, Bolton gets the news of Rob's marriage at the end of August. So when Tyrion does meet with Tywin after the Battle of Blackwater, so that's several weeks, a few weeks after that, in the beginning, beginning of Tyrion 1 is in the beginning of September. So the news already reached Tywin, presumably, and also Bolton, that Rob married Dane. So when he sends the letters and everything, they already know. So I think
good info. Like,
yeah. And I also wanted to just to note that it's the first time we meet Qyburn, right? Or did we meet him before through Arya chapters?
Yeah, I think this is the first time, but I could be getting that wrong.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this is the first time.
And I love the little slippery, oh, so, you know, what's a big, big, clever mace like you doing in a little place like this? And, oh, well, you know, I just kind of lost my chain and that. Let it...
Yeah, it's interesting how George just puts him there right now, and he's going to become such an important part of Cersei's story afterwards. And yeah, just...
Well, there's beautiful, delicious foreshadowing and irony, because Qyburn's going to create the champion that Jaime should have been, I guess. So yeah.
Yeah.
It's absolutely delicious. Anything out on this chapter?
Just maybe one last thing is that, like, as we read that, even though we are technically in a camp of the good guys, because technically Bolton is still with Rob. We never feel safe. Like, okay, that's because we're in the head of Jaime, but in the Arya chapters, it was the same. It just doesn't feel good to be at the Harren Hall, and that's ever the case with Bolton.
And
something
also
is,
with Harren Hall itself.
Is wrong.
I think like the way George just keeps emphasizing just how massive the castle is, like to go through the walls is like going through a tunnel. It feels really oppressive. It feels really unsafe. It's always shifting hands. Like even one of his minions is like, oh, I'm going to be the Lord Master left. Like it's always shifting and slippery. You can't keep hold of it. And then especially with Bolton, like the first thing that George keeps pointing out to us is from Jamie's eyes, he's seeing the sigils and the flags and seeing that it's the flayed man. And you just think, like in retrospect, of course, because we know about the Red Wedding, it's obvious, but should you really trust a bunch of people that have flayed men on their flags? It's like, I always feel when you get there are like African nations that have machetes on their flag. Is that a good sign? Maybe not. Anyway, that's
you should also add if they have an AK-47 on the flag as well. That's probably not good.
Yeah, exactly.
But machetes and AK-47s on your flag, something's not right.
Signals of intent, no? Flayed men also.
And flayed men.
Exactly, the triumvirate of evil. Okay, so if there's nothing left on Jaime 4, then we will jump forward 4 chapters to Cat 4. The events take place on the same day. And I believe it is Nadia who's going to do the summary.
Yeah, okay, so Cat 4, Foster Tully has passed away, and Cat, Rob, and his bannermen have gathered to send him to his eternal rest. They've laid his body in a funeral boat with his armor, shield, and a wooden sword. 7 men, including Rob and lame Lothar Frey, who has just arrived to negotiate Edmure's wedding to a Frey girl, launched the boat into that cumbersome. On the battlements, Cat, Edmure, and the Blackfish watch the boat reach the center of the channel. Edmure tries to fire a flaming arrow into the boat, but fails each time. And finally, frustrated, he thrusts the boat towards the Blackfish, who manages to hit the boat, even though it's almost out of sight. Edmure, embarrassed, quickly moves away from Cat, and she and the Blackfish go to join Rob and Lane. Cat thinks of how Lysa has not even bothered to reply to the news of her father's death, and there's been no news of Ian and Jaime either. Lothar Frey approaches them and asks for an audience with Rob, which he agrees to. Rob asks Cat for a word in private and leads her to the court. Rob is hopeful they'll reach an accord with the Freys, which they need more than ever after the needless battle and defeat at Dusk and Dale. Rob intends to trade Martin Lannister for Robert Glover and regrets not trading Jaime Lannister for Sansa when his mother first urged him to. This is when Rob says, I've won every battle, yet somehow I'm losing the war. Rob tells Cat that Sansa has been married to Tyrion Lannister. Cat can only think of how Tyrion promised to take Jaime for Sansa, and now it's never going to happen. Rob points out that with Bran and Rickon dead, Sansa is now his heir. Cat tries to convince him to bend the knee, but Rob refuses. They argue and Cat gets upset and leaves, but she later joins Rob at dinner. And after it's over, the Westerlings excuse themselves and everyone gets down to business. Lothar Frey tells them they've heard from the 2 Walders that were boarded at Winterfell. He tells them Winterfell has been burned by Theon when the Northern Lords tried to take it back from the Ironborn. He tells them Sir Roderick is dead and the women and children were saved and taken to the Dreadfort by Ramsay Snow. And no one knows where Theon is. Lame Lothar says that Lord Rey will agree to a marriage alliance if Rob apologizes face-to-face. When Rob agrees, Lothar tells them that Edmure will marry Lord Walder's daughter, Roslyn. Edmure wants to meet her first, but the Freys insist that the wedding must happen once or else the alliance is off. In private, Edmure expresses his anger and wants to refuse, but Brynden insists that he must accept to make up for the Battle of the Hordes, and they force Edmure into accepting.
Poor Redmure, poor stupid feckless Edmure.
I know, it wasn't even his fault, as
I
you
know. I feel like I'm softening. I used to be so harsh on Edmure. I feel I'm softening in my old age, my frail dotage.
He's gone through a lot. But what is it that Kat says in this chapter? Yeah. Something about like when he's saying, well, I don't want to marry right now. And she said she thinks like, wait, does he maybe want to like put it off and then like, you know, back out after the war? But she calls it like, you know, she basically says, like, chastises herself for thinking that about him. And I'm like, no, that's probably an accurate thought.
I mean, I just feel so bad for him trying to shoot that arrow into the boat. And you just say, oh, it's just excruciating to read the first time you read it.
Yeah, or, you know, screwing up, you know, Rob's horses or, you know, all the other things he does.
Yeah, he really is just a poor unfortunate. Sorry, Matt, I was just about to say, any thoughts on the chapter?
Yeah, like Edmure just doesn't have the right personality to like fit well into this world. Like if he were in our world this day and age, he'd be one of like the best screenwriters of all time with all the stuff he's gone through. Like,
but he would have been a great like second or third son, right?
Yeah, probably true as well.
I just feel in Britain in the sort of like 18th and 19th century, he would have been that third son who you would have just sort of sent off to become a reverend or, you know, sent off into the military.
Yeah.
And just sort of somehow gotten rid of. Yeah.
Yeah, he just doesn't have the qualities that are like expected of males, like in this time and age.
Yeah, and in fairness, you know, the Blackfish is a fearsome, I mean, he has big shoes to fill, big examples around him, but he just comes across as a little bit petulant and a little bit sort of like, oh, whiny. I don't want to marry that girl.
Yeah.
Oh, and you're like, seriously, man, you're about to lose a war here. I know it's not your fault, but we all have to take one for the team.
Are they going to have singers there? A singer pissed me off one time.
But then again, like I was reading this, and like I say, I am softening towards Edmure and my frail dotage. And I was starting to view the others in this chapter more harshly and thinking, okay, Edmure is kind of obviously an idiot, but do they really think like they're getting all like, oh my God, I can't believe the Frey sent us a cripple and a bastard. But hey, he always was prickly, so I suppose that's his revenge for Rob marrying Jane. And you're like, come on, guys, you know he's prickly, you know he's powerful. Do you really think that's going to be the extent of his revenge? Do you really think this little invitation and wedding is, you know, he could have been married to, had one of his kids married to the King of the North, now he gets one of them married to Edmure. So I kind of found myself thinking, you know what? They're not that clever either, these Riverlanders. And when Kat is genuinely wondering, gosh, I haven't heard from Brienne in a while. Perhaps she's already on her way back with the girls. And you just think, Kat.
Yeah, she's just naive.
I mean, I love it. And it's love that's making you think that. But so you know what? By comparison, I feel Edmure, okay, I'll take it.
But it's the weird thing with the Red Wedding, because like they're desperate, so they're a little bit less cautious, right? And they got to go back north and all this stuff. They need him and they need this alliance. But at the same time, they don't fully trust him. Like when they get there, Kat is very much like, hey, make sure you get some food real quick, you know? And so they like once they're served food, they're like, okay, it's fine. Like no one ever breaks the guest, right? You know, so I don't know. Like they clearly had in their mind that he might be up to something, but I don't think they thought the extent of it. Like the army wasn't on ready, like, you know.
Yeah. In fact,
there hasn't been like this level of betrayal like since, you know, Aerys and, you know, what he did to Rickard and then what Tywin did to Aerys. It's not something that they've, you know, it crosses their mind because there's been peace in the realm for so many years. They just got lulled where they just weren't in the correct mindset to think about.
Yeah, they just assume he's going to ask for more marriages or ask for more money or soldiers or, you know, they're going to get screwed somehow, you know, on like the bargaining part.
Massively underestimate him. And I think that, you know, I think that speaks to them basically being quite arrogant and complacent. Again, not great traits. Yeah, you know, your house words, Rob, are winter is coming. Why not plan for the worst?
Well, yeah. Well, and it seems to be the Northerners that kind of underestimate him the most, right? Because they're a bit more honorable. And like Kat, with all the crap that we, you know, and people give Kat, it's like she's the one that's the most cautious, isn't she? She's the one that's like, this isn't right. You know, like she sees it before anyone else does.
She's also the one that's the most cautious about the Westlings. I mean, don't get me wrong. I actually have a lot of respect for Kat and I'm one of the Kat defenders. But I just thought in general, the atmosphere in the Riverlands is very complacent, naive, considering the bad position they're in. And considering that in this one chapter, they get so much bad news. They get the news about Sansa, Winterfell burning, Duskendale. I mean, it's blow upon blow upon blow. And yet they're still, it just feels like they're in this kind of phony war. It hasn't sunk in yet for them. I actually just, while we're on that subject, given that we're doing a linear reread, I thought it was interesting that although the news sort of coalesces in this chapter, we can actually work back and see how long it takes for news to travel. So it was 6 weeks to get the news about Winterfell burning, 10 days for the news of Duskendale to reach Rob in this chapter, and 5 days for Sansa's marriage, which I actually thought was quite quick. Any other comments?
Probably sent Raven to announce it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm just like a general Raven to all the major houses, you know. They're married. But something interesting I noticed was when they're sending Hostetully down the river, and when the boat finally catches fire, she says, Kat thinks the weight of his armor would carry Lord Hoster down to rest in the soft mud of the riverbed, in the watery halls where the Tullys held the turning port, which schools of fish their last attendance. And that sounds so much like the Ironborn and how they view somebody drowning, that, you know, they're going to the drowned god's
halls. Yeah, good point.
Right, and, right.
Yeah, and the dragons were ruled for hundreds of years by, you know, the Ironborn. So I was just thinking that, you know, maybe this is one of the things that just, one
left
of those cultural
custom.
Things that just stayed behind, yeah, after the Iron, even after the Ironborn left.
Yeah, I've kind of wondered that, like, because they were, you know, they were never part of the Seven Kingdoms, right? So it seems like they've got a mixture of different cultures from people who ruled them briefly.
Yeah, yeah, and they follow the Seven, right? And they, I'm assuming they bury their dead, but the Tully's obviously gone.
Yeah. Is Kat right? Should Rob have bent the knee at this point?
No.
No.
He would have died anyway.
The better question is, could he have bent the knee? I don't think that's an option.
What? Because he's
only
a North
because it's Tywin. It's also because it's Tywin. Tywin would have executed him anyway.
Well, I was just going to say, the issue that Rob really has is that he's brought the Riverlands basically into this northern kingdom that he created, which is a huge problem for them because they're, you know, historically impossible to defend. And he can't, ideally, he could go home, consolidate his power, and, you know, say, I'm king in the north for quite a while before someone would have to come deal with him, winter comes, etc., and, you know, play this out, and who knows what's going to happen down south. And that's sort of what he intends to do, in a way, is go back and retake the north, but he doesn't really have that luxury because he's abandoning everyone in the Riverlands.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting,
yes,
isn't it?
Exactly.
Hypothetically, if Ned Stark had married a lady from, I don't know, Dorne or something, so that the Riverlands just wasn't an immediate ally, would ultimately Rob have been better off because he wouldn't have had contiguous but hard to defend land.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. You would have two connected kingdoms that are both a real pain for invading armies. Like you could do a, I guess it would be a sea war mostly that you'd have to worry about, right, with trade and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, economics would be the biggest issue.
Yeah. It's just, once they've accepted him as king, Rob can't just leave them behind, right? And the Riverlands cannot close their borders. It's just not possible. If they had not made him their king, he would have been so much better off.
You see, that's the point of Rob,
really,
isn't it? Like, he didn't make himself king. He was acclaimed. And, okay, so here's another counterfactual question. Could he have told them, when they're all sitting there acclaiming him king of the north, could he have said, calm down, guys. I appreciate this, but we're not fighting for that. We're just fighting, I don't know what for.
Well, they were like, "Hey, we're going to get Dad back, basically." And then by the time
at the very beginning,
by the time that happened, he died, and they're all on this high. And what are you supposed to do? They're like, "Well, like they've killed, you know, Ned. Well, we're obviously not gonna put up with that. Like, Northerners are not gonna just bend the knee. It's not their thing. So, well, Rob's the king now." And it just seems like, okay.
I just feel really bad for him. I feel he was boxed into the corner of being made king, which is almost like makes it hard for him to cut any peace deals or whatever. He's boxed into having to have the Riverlands allies because of his mum, and that is just impossible.
Well,
makes the idiot decision of marrying Jane. That's on him. But there are other ways in which he's so boxed in. Sorry, Murray. Mary. Sorry.
No. I'm sorry. I'm the one who who's interrupting. We talked about this a little bit on the Robcast, but like I feel we always consider him too much of an like passive character. Like he's been boxed in into being a king, but his reaction right there in this chapter to Kat saying this should stop and we should bend the knee is just, he says no, never, and it all concurs with his first reaction when Kat said that the Lannisters had sent someone to kill Bran, and after Ned's death as well. He's really, the reasons for the war, he's still he cannot imagine another issue than getting revenge. And in this area, he's still quite a teenager. Like, he's like, no, never, it's never going to happen. They did that and that, and I cannot forgive them. And I feel like he's more active than we think in the continuation of the war.
I agree.
Like,
I agree.
Could have stopped it.
Because, well, if don't really you think felt, the best time would have been after Ned was killed to just say, okay, we're going back home.
Exactly.
We're going back home and consolidating. Our taxes were separate, and he could have denied. He could have said, "You know, sorry, Riverlands, you're with them still." He could have abandoned all that and not really had to take everyone along with him.
I agree.
You know, but the only reason they stay is Sansa and Arya, right?
But actually, I think another reason they stay, which has nothing to do with Sansa and Arya, is I think Rob gets swept up on the tide of victory. And actually, if Rob had lost some of his battles, that might have done him better than winning all of them. Because there's a certain tide of momentum that you take land, you win. And then before you know it, you're in the Riverlands. And before you know it, you really can't pull back. I mean, he's almost like Guderian in World War II, who launches these amazing panzer strikes. It goes very far in front of his infantry. And then, of course, that works on the Western Front and it's disastrous in Russia. And I think you get so far ahead and suddenly you're cut off from everything and you can't go back and you're too split and your home territory is weak. And I actually feel Rob is a victim of his early success, and it's ironic. He would have done better.
Yeah, I think that's actually a good point. I mean, can we explore what would have happened differently? Because he never sends Theon to the Iron Islands, right? Unless he does to maybe to kind of protect the border or something, I don't know. But if he pulls the Northern Army back, the Iron Islanders aren't going to come into the North. They're probably coming in, Lannisport or maybe into the Riverlands or what their plans are, I don't know.
Yeah.
Whole different situation.
Absolutely. So basically, his two brothers are still alive and in Winterfell. He has Winterfell. He has a lot of his most senior advisors who get killed in that massacre. He has the respect of the North. Bolton doesn't betray him because he wouldn't have gone down to Jane Westling, right?
But then there's nothing getting Stannis, Tywin to go back to the West. So, I mean, whenever we do this kind of alternate history in A Song of Ice and Fire, we always kind of see everything going well. And, there's a lot of
reasons. Oh, yeah, there can be other fuck-ups, right?
Primarily narration. why all of this goes wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. But I don't think that the King in the North thing was planned. So, in that sense, yeah, he was, kind of stuck into this situation with people like the Great John.
Yeah, it's hard to say, North. King of the North, now let's all go home.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, I'm king, but I'm going to be king in Winterfell, if you don't mind. So,
yeah.
But, yeah, right in this chapter, we see him really, he kind of bear the idea of making peace.
Yeah, he's just not worthy of the title of king in the North, and that is sad. He's immature in different ways from Edmure, and once again, this leads me to the conclusion that Edmure's the most obvious whiny dick, but there are others.
I feel like Edmure's main fault is mostly that he's not as extraordinary as everyone else. And he's not that smart. He's not that good at fighting and archery skills. But he's not that bad. But everyone is giving him a hard time because he's not as good as he should be. And so, yeah, he's also kind of vain and arrogant because he's always depreciated in a sense. Like, I really felt for him in this scene where he misses his father's boat, and I'm like, I feel for his humiliation, you know, and I feel like it has been this way a big part of his life. And
I agree.
That's also what's made him so vain and dickish.
I'm basically almost doing a 180. I've gone from thinking Edmure deserves all hate for all time to having some love for the Edmure.
I mean, didn't they talk about that a couple of rereads ago? We talked about his decision to leave Riverrun and go out after Tywin. It's like, well, you know he's not great, and you left him in charge. I mean, because he's the Lord or whatever. But you could have had someone better making the calls if you were really worried about it.
Yeah. Anyone with anything else in this chapter? Matt, any other observations?
I don't think I have much. There's just mention of a few things with the Dusk and Dale and stuff that just kind of lead to future heirs. The main thing being, this is kind of like the last we hear about Martin Lannister, who is the most likely heir to Casterly the Rock, just because everyone in front of him is likely to be dead by the end of the series. But that's about it.
Yeah,
but that's
he's hiding Bright Roar. He's got Bright Roar. He's hiding.
There were two sentences that got my attention. So when Kat and Rob talk about the idea that Rob might die, it's really like unbearable to Catelyn. And she says, if anything befell you, I would go mad. And I think that's kind of a foreshadowing for Lady Stoneheart. She does. I mean, she is mad. And another thing is when they get the news of the sack of Winterfell, well, those are altered news because that's not exactly what happened. But
oh, yeah, Ramsay.
Catelyn says something. Yeah, exactly. She says something like, or she thinks something like, the world gets darker every minute. And I feel like that's a great recap of what we feel reading these cat chapters. Like everything, every chapter is another blow or multiple blows. And it feels more and more doomed for the Stark cause.
The blow upon the bruise.
Yeah.
This is actually the first real like confirmation we get that Ramsay is alive. It's kind of hinted at in an earlier Bran chapter, but this is kind of like the first.
Oh yeah. Like, good point.
Thing we get where Ramsay, the whole Ramsay and Reek switch.
Linearly or in the published order?
In the published order, because the Bran 2 comes after this linearly, but there's a hint of the bastards men running around in Bran 2 that comes before this published in the published order.
Okay, well, good discussion. If there's nothing else on this chapter, then we can move on to the next one. So after Cat, we jump forward a mammoth 22 chapters to Dany 5, which, you know, we've commented on this before. The Dany chapters just seem to be written as a separate story and then just sprinkled at intervals throughout the book. But actually, this action takes place just the next day on November 14th, even though it's like 300 pages later in my edition. And I believe it's Mary who's going to summarize this chapter for us. Good luck.
I think I managed to have it quite short, despite the huge chapter that was.
So many pages.
Yeah. So we left Dany at Yunkai, surrounded by freed slaves. She's now on the way to Meereen, and she's followed by a host of 80,000, which is huge, but only half of that is trained men. The Meereenese retreated before her, leaving nothing for the freedmen to feed on and nailing a child slave up on every milepost on the way. Dany is determined to take the city, and once at Meereen, they set out camp and the great masters send out a hero. Dany doesn't know who to send to fight him, or even if she will send someone, because does it really matter? And she finally decides to send Belwas the Strong, because he was a former slave, so if he loses, well, that's okay. And if he wins, it's a huge blow to the Great Masters. It turns out Belwas does defeat the hero and shames the city. She then gathers her advisors and war leaders for a council. They have nothing to feed their army and freedmen with, no way of building siege towers, and they cannot storm the walls. Jorah advises her to leave Meereen and go to Westeros, but that the road will be long and that many freedmen will die following her. Dany cannot bear the idea of leaving Meereen, though, and thinks of the slave children. Bronn Ben Plum, new commander of the Second Sons, then tells her of a way in the city, the sewers. Dany doesn't make any decision and asks them to leave her. They do, but as they're leaving, the Viserion flies to Ben Plum and Dany remarks that he must like him. We then get the story of Plum and his ancestor who were the Targaryen princess. Then he leaves and Dany thinks of her dragons and the three heads she needs to ride them. She wonders if Daario might be one and loses herself in thoughts of him, kissing him, marrying him. To clear her head, because she clearly needs it, she goes out with Missandei and Arston. In the Freedmen's camp, she is taken down on horse by Mero, former captain of the Second Sons, disguised among her freedmen. Arston rescues her and kills him. Dany goes back to her tent, and as Jorah arrives, she asks that Arston be knighted, but the old squire refuses, and Jorah too. Jorah then draws his sword and asks Arston who he really is. Arston confesses that he has not told her the whole truth about him, and Jorah finally recognizes him as Barristan Selmy and exposes him as a traitor to the Targaryens. Tommy tells his story and asks for forgiveness and assures that he is loyal to Dany. He tells her that Viserys and her were watched and that since she wed Khal Drogo, there's been an informer at her side. She refuses to believe him because only Jorah has been with her since the beginning. But Jorah confesses and tries to say that it was only at first before he came to know her and love her. Between fury and grief, Dany orders them to leave, but to go where? And finally, she knows where to send them. End of chapter.
And then you would have had to wait another 30 chapters to find out where that was. And then we wonder at the top of this podcast whether George is cruel or not. I mean, he's inherently cruel.
Is this the biggest separation in chapters we've had so far?
Yeah, it is. I did.
I mean, this is like a huge, huge jump.
Yeah, there was also a huge jump between like the Theon chapter where Winterfell... Like, there's a huge jump between the time where we think maybe Bran and Rickon are dead and the time where we
I don't mean like the continuation of a story. I just meant like linearly how we jump around in the published order.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. But that's Dany,
but yeah,
right?
Like, you waited for forever to find out what happened in Winterfell.
Yeah, also true. But this is the problem is the Dany chapters are always the furthest apart. And then as the books get bigger, the gaps get bigger, right? So...
Mm.
Okay, great summary, actually. Thoughts, feelings, observations, criticisms? Matt, let's go with you first. You're the new guy.
Again.
Safe by Nadia.
Dany again seems to have kind of a similar problem to Rob in that she is pretty good at winning battles, right? I mean, she hasn't been defeated yet, even though she started out with this small army. But it's only later when she starts ruling that we see her start getting into trouble because she doesn't understand how to do that. And I think that's kind of been Rob's problem as well. Like, he understands military strategy. Just
can't rule.
It's everything else. Yeah, it's everything else that he has trouble with.
Yeah, good observation. Matt?
So yeah, I just had to look some things up here. So the Great Pyramid is mentioned that it's 800 feet tall, which is fun. So for reference, the wall is listed as 700 feet. The Great Pyramid of Giza is only 481 feet tall. So George goes really overboard with this stuff.
Wow, that means that the wall is a lot less tall than I thought it probably was.
Yeah.
Because I've seen the Great Pyramid of Giza, 700? And that's big.
Yeah.
But I kind of thought that I would have thought the wall would be more than twice the Great Pyramid of Giza. Huh.
Well, the wall, I mean, George has always said he screwed up on the wall, right?
So how tall is the wall meant to be?
Well, I mean, he describes it in the book, and it's like it's very tall, but I think he said it was really only supposed to, like, he should have made it only, you know, like less than 50 feet or something. Or I remember he's given interviews on it before.
Yeah,
he screwed up by a factor of 10.
Yeah, it's like quite massive.
Yeah, it's when he went to the set for the first time, and like the wall they used was, I don't know, maybe 200-300 feet tall. And so I think he just thought that was more of a reasonable number to make it. It's also because, like, I'm actually curious if the wall is actually going to physically come down, just because technically that would, like, the after effect of the dust coming off of that would ruin a lot of the North.
Well, it'd be like Krakatoa, basically.
Right.
Well, if the whole thing just came down all at once instead of just a section.
Right.
I mean, I kind of like the idea of the wall being superhumanly tall, because it's built by magic, right? So it should be...
Yeah, but then you have the builders that have to, like, try to maintain it, and it just seems like a joke that these people are like, oh, yeah, they make it a little bigger, and, like, really? They're just putting more ice up there? Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
And is the pyramid, I mean, part of the marine pyramid is that it's underground, no? So it's maybe the kind of, like, visible height, I don't know. Nadia, anyway, over to you.
Yeah, and I was just saying the wall is 700 feet high at its highest.
Yeah, because it feels like on the show, maybe my sense of perspective is messed up. It feels like way more than double the Great Pyramid of Giza. I don't know.
Yeah, they probably didn't build it to scale, so.
CGIA, they can do what they want. Did anyone like...
But I'm thinking about the people who have to take the stairs inside the pyramid, because I think it does say that it's as... I mean, there's as much of it underground as there is above ground. And there's entire chapters of Barristan just walking up and down stairs. I think it sounds exhausting.
Poor old man.
They needed to get some kind of like winch system in there, right? Some sort of early form of lift going on.
Yeah, you would have thought they'd have human powered elevators, you know, with all the slaves and stuff. They would have done that.
Or just get carried up on palanquins or something.
Yeah. Poor slaves. They would riot. I'm sure they tried it and it didn't work.
We've established that on the architecture point of view, like, Martin isn't really on point. Like, the Eyrie is also, like...
just numbers, not, basically.
Practical?
Yeah, not really realistic.
But it looks cool.
Well, that's the point, yes. There's got to be a little fantasy in this.
They can't even use it for the entire year. Like, they have to come down for, like, half the time.
Yeah. Did any, when you guys, maybe you can't remember when you read it the first time, did any of you remember who the Frak Mero was when he emerges to try and kill Danny? I was like, who? What? This?
Oh, I did not.
I was like, oh really? My God.
I would assume that I didn't remember, but...
I just love these, like, random... There's, like, every time we get a Danny chapter, we get an assassination attempt. And I get that George is trying to make a point, but it gets tedious for me.
Yeah, but it did feel like when Danny was like, why didn't you tell me that he had gotten away? And I'm just like, as the reader, I'm like, I don't even remember that guy existed, so, you know, I don't know.
Man, I feel so, like you go for it.
Thanks. Matt, you were the one making a parallel with Rob, or was it Nadia? Sorry.
Nadia, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, okay. Well, in any case, I think that right now is the point where she arrives to Marine and she is confronted to the decision to either stay or go to Westeros. And, like, maybe we can discuss that a little bit, because, as we know, she's stuck in Meereen for the whole of Dance and probably more. And, like, was Jorah's advice the good one? Like, should she have gone to Westeros at this point?
Of course.
Well, but how would she have made it over there? Like, the only army she has is, like, Yan Salid, right? And she has to get them across the Narrow Sea. And she only has 3 ships.
I mean, even just to get to the Free Cities through this hell of a road that's supposed to go throughout the continent, it seems like at the moment they stopped at Astapor, they didn't think it through. Like, if she's going to buy an army, how is she going to move it afterwards?
How do you feed it? How do you move it? Yeah.
I don't think she intended on buying them all. It was only when she saw them and heard how cruelly they'd been trained that she just couldn't stop herself, and she got... I mean, she took, like, all of the Ansari, right? Even the trainees.
Yeah.
It wasn't
she wanted all their stock. Yeah. Don't you think that she kind of... Jorah brings it up, but don't you think she at first didn't want to do it at all? And maybe she was like, well, yeah, I'll open to maybe getting, like, a small force that, you know, for protection, and she needs to build her ranks. But then she's like, oh, yeah, dragons, I can just take the whole thing because dragons...
I mean, like, strategically speaking, to be honest, she probably should have just stayed in Astapor. Like, it just at some point, she needed to stop, just because she has to build up her force. She has to get ships to transport.
Yeah, it's by the water. It's...
Yeah. She has to, like, make initial contact with Westeros in the first place, just because the only way she's going to be successful is to have allies going in. And she needs to wait for her dragons to get bigger. Like,
and Astapor is one city. She takes all of the Unsullied, takes over the city. There's a lot of wealth, plenty enough to, like, contract ships to come and take her if she really wanted to.
I mean, basically, her only real asset is the dragons, because she doesn't really have proper allies. So, yeah, until they're fighting size, she needs to cool her heels.
Yeah, I agree. Like, her whole crusade against the slave masters is very well intended, but very unrealistic.
It gets her enemies too early. If she had stayed in Astapor, I think you probably wouldn't get all of the other slave cities coming after her like they do.
Yeah.
Because they just think she's going to move on shortly, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I will say, though, to be fair, though, that type of stuff does, like, help spread the word across to get her potential allies in the future, you know, mainly with Volantis as well, if that's a possibility. She wouldn't have had that possibility in the first place without taking Meereen.
Actually, yeah, that's a good point.
Except that it's not going to be Volantis, more Braavos, right? Because Volantis is still a slave city and a big part of the slave trade.
Right, yeah. She has potential troops there, and freed slaves.
We always seem to think of about how Dany is failing in ruling Meereen, and how when she freed all these slaves, she kind of just bound herself to the Slaver's Bay, and now she can't get to Westeros. But we never think of it from the former slave's perspective until, you know, we see that old lady in Meereen, in Volantis, who sort of goes, like, you know, tell who who tells Tyrion, I think, tell her that we are waiting for her, tell Dany that we're waiting, tell Daenerys that we're waiting for her. And you can see how important it is to those people that Dany be kind of like this just catalyst in finally resulting in all of these thousands of people being freed from slavery. So I think we sometimes judge Dany a little harshly because we never think of how important it is to those people to be free.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. That is a good point.
Yeah, I mean, she's like doing what's right for people, obviously. I just need to get frustrated. No one's trying to say freeing slaves is wrong, Nadia. I mean, obviously.
I mean, we've all done it, right? We all think, why isn't she going back? And she has these ships and she has them sullied. So we never, think of it from their perspective.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, with the benefit of long hindsight, I have this Zen approach. Well, militarily, she can't really go back till her dragons are big. But at this point in A Storm of Swords, I remember this very viscerally when I first read it all those many years ago, maybe 10 years ago or longer. I was thinking, God, Dany, are you seriously not? Is this your decision? You're going to stay in Meereen? You're really not going to go back to Westeros? And little did I know that would be like, books later, she still would be stuck in Meereen.
Yes.
God, it's so depressing.
Yeah.
And now she's like, even at this point in the book, she's even further back. Like, she's gone back to the Dothraki.
Yeah, she has to go all the way. She has to go all the way back to Vase Dothrak, like, before she starts towards Westeros.
Although I at least feel with that final sort of wandering in the desert wilderness and the the visions and the miscarriage or whatever that was, that all starting to bleed again, becoming fertile. I feel like at least she's on the move. Like, not literally going in the right way, but figuratively, she's getting back to Westeros. Yeah, exactly.
Something is happening.
Yeah, the story is actually moving. The Meereenis not.
She's not like busy trying to please all of these like slave masters and who should I marry? And you're like, no, none of this matters. No.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's the main thing where she's finally embracing the proper fire and blood. Like, you need the balance of like being nice, but also having the fire and blood attitude. Like, you need that balance to be able to.
It is kind of surprising that that like training her dragons or learning how to ride like that is never really is a priority for her. They're really young, but like they've gotten big enough to where like obviously she can ride on them, and like there's no like, hey, can we get someone to tell me everything we know about that?
She has started to think about who the riders will be, even if it's just because she's got the hots for Dario.
Isn't that how
and she's like 14.
Yeah.
Isn't that how Priyapri got Dany to go to the House of the Undying? Because he promised her that the Undying can teach you the ways of all Valyria and
good
how they used
point.
To change that.
Right, right. But at that point, they're still too small to actually concern yourself with being able to train them too much. She teaches them some Valyrian, but.
Yeah, but I'm just thinking that maybe that experience has kind of like ruined it in the sense that she can't trust anyone to teach her because
it's like soured her on it. Yeah.
Once. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's why Tyrion needs to get there and explain how he just wants a small dragon. And
yeah, well, he's like, there.
He read all the books already.
Ultimately, though, and I said this at the top of the hour, I mean, I just feel these Dany chapters, because we meet her again after a while, there's all sorts of stuff happens. I just find they don't prompt the same kind of character analysis, emotional readings as I get from the other chapters. Maybe that's me and bias, but I found it hilarious how few notes I had on this compared to the other chapters. Don't know if others
even though it's the biggest chapter.
Yeah, I don't know. It just doesn't prompt anything in me.
But a lot happens here, really. I mean, a lot of like key moments and kind of stuff that is really easy to remember when you're just going through thinking about the story later on.
Yeah, I mean, I remember being very shocked by the unveiling of Aston. Really shocked me the first time because my first ever read of the books was very naive. Like, I didn't realize Renly was gay. So
I was the same way.
I definitely didn't realize it was Barristan. I loved the unmasking of Jorah. I think it's laughable when he's like, but I've fallen in love with you. That makes it all okay, right?
Yeah, that was dumb.
Yeah, he's just an absolute. I have so little time for him.
Yeah, he's really annoying in this chapter, and probably the one before that also. You can see that before that, there was kind of, she was listening to his advice, and he was helpful. But in this chapter, he's just whiny all the time, and he's like, nope, that won't do, nope, that either, and yeah, no, that won't work. And you're like, shut up, just try to be constructive. Like,
in
there's
fact,
nothing
with Edmure, Rob, and Jorah. This is a whiny episode. This is an episode of whiny ass people. Apart from Jamie, doesn't whine, and Jamie's just had his hand chopped off. And then just, you know, gets his hand seared and then operated on by Qyburn, and
okay,
he doesn't
that's
whine.
Because you love him, because he does kind of want to die
in this chapter. That's true. He's a little bit whiny until Brienne bitch slaps him and calls him a coward. That's true.
Exactly.
So basically all the men in this episode, all the main men, are very whiny. There you go. shout out for Lord Ossifer Plum. Brown Ben Plum's ancestor.
He had
a 6-foot dick.
Yeah, not inches.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, yeah. 6 feet. It's because he died. Oh, see, I looked this up. It's because he died like during that pregnancy.
So 6 feet under.
Yeah, that's the story. Yeah. So,
yeah, exactly.
The only way to make it work. Yeah.
So yeah.
His wife was Elena, right? Her name is Elena.
Right. Yeah.
She was Bela the Blessed Sister.
Yeah, it's possible that Aegon the Unworthy was the actual father.
And not
Ossifer.
Poor Ossifer.
No, but that was with Dana the Defiance.
And we can't forget Luckamore the Lusty.
Yes, that's brilliant. But I do like, because that's George, isn't it? George is all about how things happen and then they change in the telling. And there's alt history. And like the idea that this guy with a 6-foot dick basically just, it starts off as a rumor because he was 6 foot under when he fathered a kid, and then it gets twisted. I like that. That's very George.
That's fun.
Anything else in this chapter? Or indeed any of the chapters? Thematic resonances, reading them in this linear way, so it's sort of, you know, between the chapters all at once.
Well, you said it, they're all whining.
And just Rob being stuck in the Riverlands, wanting to go back north, and even stuck in Slaver's Bay and wanting to go to Westeros. It's just all the same thing.
Yeah, rulers being stuck. I mean, in a sense, it's kind of, it's a theme of this whole series, and you see it very clearly with Dany and Jon in Dance with Dragons, that it's all about rulers who kind of get what they want and yet find that they're absolutely stuck and circumscribed in their choices. So Rob wins all the battles but finds he's in an invidious position. Same with Dany, same with Jon later on.
Very invidious.
Invidious.
The comeback of the invidious position.
Darth Vidious. I fucking love that
word. Favorite word now.
It really is. It has been for some time. Cool. Okay. Any last thoughts, or shall I wrap up? No? Okay. Well,
no, not really.
Well, on that Darth Vidious note, we will wrap up this episode, the 43rd episode of the great Song of Ice and Fire linear reread. It has been a pleasure podcasting with you all. Thank you very much to Nadia, Mary, to Adam, and new podcaster Matt. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for the hosting. Very smooth, as always.
And Matt, I hope we definitely see you back maybe on a Dragoncast. In the meantime, listeners, if you feel like it once again, please feel free to vote for Vassals of Kingsgrave or anybody else, because we're lovely and cuddly, at thepodcastawards.com. And you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Just search for VOK Podcast and you'll come across us. And yeah, I think that's pretty much it for the episode. For those of you watching Game of Thrones, enjoy the new season. For those of us not watching Game of Thrones, we'll probably put out a few more episodes of the reread, but we'll drop the frequency a little bit just to let all those TV casts go out, and look forward to speaking to you all soon. So thanks everyone, and goodbye. Bye.
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 Bye. We'll be right back.
I just checked. This one's already uploaded.
I'm not going to lie. When Matt was like rebooting it or switching to the iPhone, I did edit the first little recorded bit of the intros.
Oh,
oh my goodness.
Yeah. Are you
serious? I do see you already have the post like as a draft up there. All you got to do is put the links in.
Yeah.
Very sly. Very sly.
Very. Yeah. I like being, you know. This is how I am at work as well. I just like everything prepared. I'm a good girl guide. Those lessons stick with you for life. I'm excited for you watching the show, though. Always feel a bit of a...
I'm feeling so left out.
I wish you guys were coming along with us for the ride, but I also get it.
Yeah, not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. But, I mean, I am really looking forward to the Rob podcast. A couple of us are thinking of doing one on the 5-year gap and what that did to George's stories and the invidious position he put himself in.
Ooh, that would be good. Because that really screwed him up.
I think it's
going to be just, a lot of bitterness.
That just screwed him up so
basket.
Bad.
Yeah, so that's not going to be a happy place. For after-show purposes, does anyone have any other podcasts they want to pimp out? Adam, what have you got coming up?
All kinds of stuff. We just put up a pre-show for season 7, just discussing, you know, trailers and various things. That went up last night.
That's what makes me sad, because this time of year is when I have to delete Vox without listening to them, and I never do
that.
You have
to, like, swipe right and
whatever
it is. But then you can, later on, when you watch the show, you can maybe go through anew and experience them. I don't know.
Exactly.
But then we've got, I got that Hobbit cast coming at some point. You know.
Oh, nice.
It's been edited for like a year. I don't know. We'll see when I put
that
out.
The Hobbit episode?
The second part of it that we recorded
like
a year ago.
Wait, did that never come out?
No, that was my fault.
I didn't even notice because I was there, so I didn't like...
See, yeah, so we
were... It's okay, because that book isn't going anywhere, in fairness.
Yeah, I was so keen on it, and like I recorded it, and then I put the other one out like a week before we were recording the second one. I'm like, I'm just gonna get them out so close together, and then I edited it, and then it got lost in the editing, and then it took me like 6 months before I sat down to do it again. So now it's basically done. I just am trying to figure out when to publish it.
Hilarious. Nadia, have you got anything coming up that hasn't already been covered?
I've been meaning to put up the CTA for Religion Cast, but
nice.
I haven't gotten around to it yet. Yeah, I won't be able to record for like another month or so, but... Yeah,
but that's okay. You can wait till the show's done and then people will be free.
Yeah,
again.
But I want to get it going because it'll probably need like a lot of set stuff, so...
Yeah, cool. Mary?
Oh, yeah, we...
Sorry.
I was just saying, we also have our like 80s action movie retrospective at the end of the month.
Oh, it's actually happening. That, awesome.
Yeah, the record will. I don't know when it'll come out, probably after the season finishes.
That's cool. But...
Nice. Mary, anything you're going to be on?
I'm hosting the Sense8 podcast, which
yes!
should have happened a few
it's
weeks
happening.
Ago, but we're doing that hopefully on Wednesday. And I'm editing the Robcast. I'll send it to you when it's done, Bina, so that you
Fantastic.
Can listen to it.
Sounds amazing. I can't wait. And Matt, like, you know, please feel free to jump. Hopefully this was funnish. Feel free to jump on anything else or kick off your own podcast.
Yeah, to be honest, I've already have like notes for the next few Jamie chapters and the next Cat chapter too.
Okay.
I really dove into this. It's why I don't like reread all the time, because once I do, I just like dive in first.
Excellent. Well, Julie noted whenever I get Jamie chapters, I'll be ringing you up and seeing if you can be on. So that sounds.
Yeah,
great.
The next two Jamie chapters are really good.
Yeah, I agree. We'll make that happen. Okay, that's a wrap. Thank you guys all so much for being on. This has been fun. It's quite nice having slightly smaller groups because it just feels like it, you know, flows a bit easier maybe.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tomorrow night will be interesting.
How many people have you got on for Dragon Cast?
I haven't decided yet, but there are quite a few people in the...
Don't get
in, like,
drunk
the,
on the power.
The recording
Don't get
dread.
Drunk on the power.
I'm trying to think, like, well, there are some people in there who I'm like, I'm pretty sure aren't even going to be
Come
around.
Be
I don't know. We'll see.
Okay, well, let's see what happens. Cool. Have a lovely afternoon, evening, guys, and speak to you soon.
Thanks, Bina.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.